Hello, I'm Dr. Pamela Brewer, and you are listening to Men's Monday here on Mind Talk, the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. On Men's Monday, we focus on all things for and about men. And today's guest is Randy Flood. Randy is the co-founder and director of the Randy Institute for the Prevention and Treatment of Masculopathy. I think I got that right, Randy, did I?
Yes, you did.
Welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Pam.
Now, the first thing we got to do is describe to the listeners what masculopathy is.
Well, you mentioned masculopathy. The book we wrote is Masculopathy, Understanding and Healing the Malaise of American Manhood. So we're trying to answer that question, what is the malaise of American manhood? And some people may have some different views on that as well. But we're describing the malaise of American manhood as a problem with no name. And we decided to come up with a name for it, and we came up with masculopathy, which is a pathology of masculinity. And basically, it's when society socializes boys to exaggerate masculine traits such as aggressiveness, control, violence, competition, dominance, while at the same time reducing or minimizing softer human traits, which we typically associate with the feminine, such as compassion, sensitivity, empathy, cooperation, collaboration, vulnerability. And so there's half of a person's humanity gets developed at the expense of pursuing the pinnacle of masculinity. And so we've had conversations, I think, in the 21st century about American manhood, and we are hopeful that this new terminology will give us a name so that we can have a more precise and more thoughtful discussion about what we see as the malaise in American men and what we hope to provide a more broad and more wholehearted definition of masculinity that's more fit for the 21st century.
Now, when you say we, you are the co-author with Charlie Donaldson. And as you said, the name of your book is Masculopathy. Now, already there's somebody listening who is not very happy that you have identified, you and your co-author have identified this negative term and attached it to the concept of masculinity. So before some folks turn away because they're horrified and upset, what do you want them to know as we continue our conversation today?
Well, I want them to know is that we've developed this term not to demonize men or not to throw masculinity at the curb of humanity or looking at the beauty of masculinity of men. We want to celebrate masculinity. We think masculinity is beautiful. We support it in the development of boys. And so we want boys to be able to climb trees and catch fish and chase around frogs and chase each other around with plastic swords and imaginary dragons and all that stuff that we celebrate and love boys for. But we really believe that we have to have a really honest and pointed conversation, and especially in the 21st century, when we see, for example, why are women graduating at higher levels from colleges than males? Mm. When you know, 20, 30 years ago, that wasn't the case at all. Why in this recent recession, where people lost lots of jobs, are people calling it the man-cession? Because we're moving out of a manufacturing economy where we relied on brawn and aggression and dominance into a more service, more what they're calling a connection economy, where you got to have human skills such as collaboration and communication. So what we're seeing is that men are falling behind in this pursuit of what it means to be fit in the 21st century. So this term, like I started out with, is not designed to bastardize masculinity or make it into a bad thing. We just want to provide a term that says when we socialize boys into half their humanity and we only emphasize you to be a real man, you've got to be tough and strong and suck it up and man up, and we emphasize that in such a rigid and aggressive way that we're not really preparing boys for a more wholehearted masculinity that's going to be fit for this new millennium, we're actually socializing them into a pathology of masculinity that we want to call masculopathy, so we can have a more honest description or a more honest discussion about this issue.
And I think sometimes when you are able to put a label on something, you're able to make it a bit smaller, less overwhelming, and begin to have a conversation about it.
Right. And Betty Friedan, you know, wrote The Feminine Mystique decades ago and talked about a problem with no name and trying to find out why are suburban white women who have it all and have, you know, the June Cleavers of the world living in suburban America, why are they depressed? Why are they looking for mother's little helper? And why are they starving themselves with anorexia?
Mm.
Because there was a lot of education at that time about female socialization, about how society puts women in a box and puts them in a gender straitjacket, and we were developing half their humanity in pursuit of femininity. And so women have done a really nice job, and some, again, will disagree, maybe been overzealous in their mission and approach, but to try to give young girls this message that, you know, you can be a girl and you can play sports and you can also sew buttons on. You can be a girl and you can be a trial attorney, or you can be a OBGYN doc or a nurse or a kindergarten teacher. We give girls much greater permission to live into their strengths as a human being. We're not doing a very good job giving boys that same kind of message, and we hope this new term will provide a discussion that can help us do a better job at raising our boys.
Now, you quote in your book that a figure that is stunning, not surprising, but certainly sort of pulls one up short when you say that between the ages, and you're quoting a publication where you say that between the years, I'm sorry, of 1982 and 2013, 66 of the 67 mass shooters were men.
Right.
And, you know, while we kind of know that because we do, somehow seeing it gives a different urgency, perhaps, and importance to the work that you're trying to do with your work and with this book.
Right. I think that if women were shooting at that same rate, we'd be asking the question. Social scientists, media pundits would be having talk shows all across America about what is going on with our girls, what's going on with our females. They're coming to our schools and they're shooting up our schools. They're going into our theaters and our churches and mosques. What's going on? And I think that sometimes the dominant culture gets to frame the conversations or gets to frame the problems.
Yeah.
When you look at even a matter of race, there's been, of those shooters, most of them have been white males. And so the dominant culture can sometimes go unexamined. And so we believe that although we can look at gun control, we can look at mental health, those are important discussions, but why aren't we talking about the mental health of young boys, the mental health of males, and what is it that prevents them from asking for help, and it's something antithetical to being male to say, I feel I need some counseling,
right,
or I'm in pain, or I'm suffering, or I'm feeling alienated and bullied and picked on, and I need to talk to someone about it. These shooters have a way of taking a very masculine approach to a problem, and most of these shooters, if you look at them in the Columbine couple, they were bullied and estranged and alienated from the what we call the man pack. And they didn't fit in, and so they took this extreme masculine approach of overpowering, dominating, powering up, and using violence to experience power and domination and annihilate people. And I think that if we talk about masculinity, we can begin to talk about what's going on in the water of our society that these boys are swimming in that's so toxic.
You just referred to something called a man pact. What's the man pact look like?
Well, the PACK is the pact that men run around in. We believe that we're all social creatures, and we all look to our tribe, our social circles, for identity, for a sense of validation about what it means to be a Lutheran, what it means to be a Mason. Mm-hmm. So we have ways of gravitating towards community. The Man Pack is the largest organized group of people that creates what we call the Man Pack, P-A-C-T, which mm-hmm. is a written set of rules about what it means to be a real man. So when we do these workshops to increase awareness, and we oftentimes will ask our audience, what does it mean when society says, man up, be a real man, take it like a man? And oftentimes people will just give us lots of the same kind of attributes that you've heard for years, and you will hear mm-hmm. Continuing, which is a real man takes control, makes it on his own, he's independent, he's aggressive, he's competitive, and he knows how to have sexual conquest, and the list goes on and on and on. And so you take the pressure of being in a pack, and if you don't fit in, then you get shamed, and you get feel ostracized, you get called names that shame you into making you feel unmanly. And that will make a man feel like he's not measuring up. And one of the features of masculopathy is what we call a weak self-concept.
Yes.
Bottom men struggle with always feeling, am I man enough? Do I have the respect of the men in my life? So the pack has a lot of pressure on how men define what it means to be a real man.
And certainly, I know I have, and I'm certain that you and your colleague have met and talked to men who will proudly say that they don't have any feelings, but they've got this way of thinking about something or doing something. But feelings, please, you know, that's sort of ladies' work. And it sounds like that's what you're really trying to free men of, because that really is an unhealthy place to be.
Yeah, what we're learning, you know, again, the social scientists are giving us good information, and we, you know, most of us have heard of what is your EQ. You know, we used to be years ago, everybody was obsessed with IQ, how intelligent you are. We measure it, we quantify it. But now research is suggesting that one of the biggest predictors of successful marriages, success in business, success in communities is a person's EQ, is their emotional quotient. And so we have learned that emotional intelligence is very important in the 21st century as we continue to grow and evolve and change and transform into our higher selves. So if we don't socialize boys into understanding their emotions, and that's the second piece of masculopathy. The mm-hmm. first piece is that weak self-concept. The second piece or component is what we call inadequate emotionality. And that is defined by not giving boys the language for emotions.
Mm-hmm.
If we do give them language for emotions, we teach them that fear, sadness are signs of weakness, are signs of being unmanly. And so if a real man doesn't feel fear, doesn't feel vulnerability, doesn't feel sadness, because that's weakness.
Right, a real man doesn't shed tears.
Real men don't shed tears.
Right.
And so a lot of men transform which is inherent. It's built in us. You cannot socialize emotionality out of boys. It's interesting that we say that women wear their emotions on their sleeve, but men's emotions are percolating in their bellies and in their hearts, and then explodes out into our streets and in our homes with violence and aggression and other kinds of behavior that's not empathic to the human condition.
So
the enemy of violence is empathy. And if you don't teach boys mm-hmm. to stay wired up to their heart, then we're not going to stop the plague of violence in our society.
We are talking to Randy Flood, who is the co-author of Masculopathy, Understanding and Healing, The Malaise of American Manhood. This is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We're going to take a break, and we will... Hello, folks. Pamela Brewer. We continue the conversation with Randy Flood, co-author with Charlie Donaldson of Masculopathy, Understanding and Healing the Malaise of American Manhood. One of the points that you both make in the book, Randy, is that your conversation about masculopathy and your work to change the painful way in which men have been socialized goes across racial lines, goes across economic lines. Is that the case?
Yes. A lot of good information we get is from the men. We do a lot of groups at our center, and we have a lot of men's therapy groups, men's domestic relationship groups, men having issues with sexual addiction and such. And so we get men in circles, and we are with them for months, years. And when they begin to take their armor off and take the mask off, we hear about the trauma in their lives. We don't give men permission to talk about the trauma in their lives because, again, men are supposed to suck it up.
Right.
And they are supposed to present to the world that nothing hurts me. I'm invulnerable. I can take it. I can man up. And so you don't hear men complain about, for example, what it was like for them to be bullied by their older brother or to be sexually abused by their female babysitter when they were young, or to have a father who would come home after World War II and was revered and was a noble man in the town's 4th of July parade, and everybody worshipped him, but you know, Friday and Saturday nights he'd drink himself into a violent rages mm-hmm. and scare his family with violence and aggression. So men begin to talk about those fears and those traumas and what it was like growing up male. And when men can do that, it gives them a chance to really be honest about their lives and begin to heal themselves. And to the extent that they can connect to their own pain and their own trauma, they're more apt to be able to connect to the pain and welfare of other people in their lives. And so that's the tandem that we're trying to help people understand. Sometimes we hear people say, well, why are men so insensitive? Or why are men more prone to violence? Or why this, why that? Well, we're saying that it's because the way that men are socialized, that process is a traumatic strain on their humanity.
Mm.
And so we want to have a realistic conversation about male socialization. You look at the news, we're having some recent news stories about a football team that had their season closed down because of ritualized hazing beating and bullying the freshmen on the football team. There's a lot of people who are upset about the football season ending, but that community, the coaches and the principals of that school system says, This is unacceptable, the way that this was handled and the way that these kids acted, and we're going to take this seriously and address it. And in this school, send the message that that's unacceptable.
And certainly there are varying views on what's been happening with the various sports figures over time who have relatively consistently, not all certainly, but some, found themselves in the news for having been violent in some way. And up until recently, you know, it's just kind of been a tiny news story and that was it, if it was a news story.
Yeah, I think there's this idea that that's just the way guys are, or you hear that phrase, well, boys will be boys.
Exactly.
You know, they're kind of made of snips and tails and, you know, snips, snails and puppy dog tails. And it's the girls that are made out of that sugar and spice and everything nice. So it's in the DNA of men to behave that way. And then so we kind of look at these bad guys of society. You know, we used to have a TV show called Bad Boys. And so we're attracted to the underbelly of when kind of masculinity goes off the tracks.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're trying to say is that we socialize boys into having a greater propensity for these kind of behaviors. So if you take the sports culture, and again, I think we're doing a better job with coaching. I think we have a long ways to go. Joel Erman is doing some good work coaching from the inside out, mm-hmm. traversing America and consulting the schools and professional organizations on coaching. But historically, the athletic sports culture was all about, you know, this hyper-masculine climate or this ethos of real men, you know, are grinding it out with, you know, war metaphors and, you know, with football in the trenches. And so then we're all of a sudden surprised when we hear of these athletes struggling with domestic violence or criminal behavior. It's kind of a package deal when you only emphasize that aggressive, dominating, competitive side of a man, and then it can be appropriate and functional on the football field. But if you handle your intimate relationships like you handle fourth down and one, you're going to have episodes where you might be upset that your partner's not giving you what you want, not telling you what you want, and you use aggression and violence to start or stop something and end up with a domestic violence charge.
So it doesn't surprise you at all when you hear about sports figures or perhaps even, you know, other men in arenas where power supposedly is the thing that they need to aim for. Doesn't surprise you at all when you hear that they've been accused of one crime or another?
No, what I'm aware of is that it's not as though statistically domestic violence happens at a higher rate in professional sports.
Right.
I think we hear about it more because it's in the media, but there's people, you know, Joe Factory and Joe Electrician that's getting arrested, you know, every Wednesday and Friday night throughout the country. What I'm saying is that we tend to glamorize professional athletes and put them on this pedestal of humanity, that these are, you know, the pinnacle of men and masculinity, and we prize them. And I'm just saying that when we hear of the Ray Rice's stories and such, it doesn't surprise me as a psychologist who's dedicated his life to studying men and writing books about men that these kind of problems exist with professional athletes. I'm merely saying that if all the training they've ever had growing up in society is the training to be a good athlete, that kind of training does not train you into being a good man, a good husband, and a good father. That's training beyond what happens in 100-yard dashes and triangles on the baseball field.
So clearly what you're talking about is a huge shift in terms of how you would like for not only men, but men and women, society at large, to really look at the concept of masculinity. You want them to look at a whole man, a whole person. He gets to have feelings just like everybody else.
Absolutely. And I think that people are afraid that if we coach and socialize boys to have feelings and to be connected to their emotions, that we're emasculating them, that we're going to make them weak, and somehow they're not going to be fully prepared for the jobs that men have to perform to be successful. We're not going to have any firefighters. We're not going to have any police officers. We're not going to have anybody charging up, you know, when 9/11 happens, to try to rescue people and sacrifice their life to try to do so. These truly heroic men that are willing to risk their physical safety for the welfare of others. And I don't believe that that's true any more than what we're seeing with the auto industry. And we bailed out the auto industry because they were stubbornly making these gas-guzzling large vehicles, SUVs, and weren't keeping up with the competition that was happening in the European auto industries. And now we're finally starting to see them make flex fuel engines and hybrids in bigger vehicles to try to create more gas economy for this 21st century automobile.
So maybe,
and I think we can do the same thing with boys. We can cross-train them. Mm-hmm. And when we train them to be in connection with their full humanity, that's going to make them more fit rather than training them to only be connected to half of it.
Well, in fact, in terms of trying to build a whole person, you're actually taking the pain and the shame of being human And you're celebrating the fact that they're human. You're wanting boys and men to understand that it's really good to be human.
Correct.
Versus this one-dimensional, as you say, character who sort of rushes to the fore and is fairly violent. I wonder what your thoughts are about the wars that we get into. Do you imagine that if we had a different view of power and masculinity, that our tendency, some would say, to rush into war would be lessened or changed?
Oh, I absolutely believe that to be true. And again, I mean, there's a time in which using aggression to protect our families or ourselves can be appropriate in situations. I'm not saying it's not ever going to be a part of our human condition anymore. But I do think that we tend to rush into violent solutions or military solutions. I interview guys in my practice sometimes, and I ask, well, one of the questions I'll ask is, you know, how many fights you've been into? And the guy will, some guys will respond, is, I don't know, probably about 100. And I'm like, 100 fights? I said, he goes, I didn't start any of them. So again, guys have this view of the world is they have to be vigilant and respond with aggression and don't let anybody, you know, stare you down, or if you take a shoulder in a crowded bar, you better look and see who shouldered you to, you know, maybe he's disrespecting you. And so guys have this way of viewing the world in a very suspicious way, and so that there can be a tendency toward seeing the world as a dangerous place, as well as you seeing violence as a solution to complex human problems. And so I think your point, Pam, about rushing into war, I think a lot of times if the president that we have in place is not responding quickly and swiftly to every foreign policy problem, we can sometimes question their manhood. We even will question putting a woman into the presidency, because right. We question whether they're going to be able to make those tough decisions and be able to, you know, send the soldiers to places. And so there's a lot of gender construction around this idea of what it means to be powerful and successful and courageous. And I think violence and war, we've glamorized it, I think, way too much, and we need to take a look at that.
Indeed.
And seeing that maybe there will be statues someday of the diplomat in a veterans park who was able to negotiate a successful treaties with his glasses on his nose with a book in his hand, rather than most of our icons and symbols are about glamorizing this soldier who was able to be violent and aggressive for noble reasons. So we have to wonder if we can begin changing our symbols and changing what we value and what we consider to be tough.
We are having a conversation with Randy Flood, co-author with Charlie Donaldson of Maskopathy, Understanding and Healing the Malaise of American Manhood. We are going to take a break, and when we come back, Randy, I'd like to get your sense of the games that are so popular these days. I'd like to get your take on those, particularly the war games and the fight games. Folks, you're listening to Mind Talk. I'm Pamela Brewer. We'll be right back. Hello, folks. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We continue the conversation with Randy Flood. Randy, what's your take on the games that exist in the world today? I mean, they're certainly very popular, and I'm not talking about the sort of, you know, friendly games. I'm talking about the games where there's shooting and killing and all kinds of violent activities. Are you concerned about those games or no?
I am, but not in a way of looking at them as the sole reason why we're seeing, for example, shooters in our our society, or the I think we're seeing, actually, if you look at the crime statistics, we're seeing a reduction in crime overall. But I do think that there's going to be a certain vulnerable group of primarily boys that are attracted to these type of games. I mean, I'm not saying girls don't play them as well. But if you have a boy, James Garbarino talks about social toxins, and he talks about this idea that there's certain kinds of kids that he would call psychologically vulnerable to the toxins in our society. And if you're a child who's has multiple stressors in your life, and you are being raised in a home, for example, where there might be domestic violence, and there might be your family struggling with poverty, there might be alcoholism, you might not be the popular kid in school, and you're being bullied, and again, you continue to add these accumulative stressors to a young boy's life, and then now let's add first-person shooter violent games, and that young boy playing, rather than, because he doesn't have any friends and he feels alienated, he spends most of his time playing these games. And what we're learning about neuroscience, and that the brain is malleable, and that the brain, especially for males, continues to develop until approximately the age of 26 before their executive functioning is fully wired. So you have this young boy's brain kind of marinating for years, violent imagery. And again, exposure to violence tends to, over time, desensitize us from the alarm of violence. I remember my young son, who's now 25, but when he was, I think, around 12 years old, when the video game started coming onto the scene more prolifically, he was playing a game with one of his friends, and he said, "Dad, look at this." And it was not a violent game. It was this game where two people were lost, and they had to swim across this lake to get to the other side. And what he discovered with his friend was that you could stop the swimmer in the middle of the lake. And over time, he would get fatigued, and then he would start yelling for help and tell you know, "I'm drowning." Mm-hmm. I listened to that, and I heard his kind of wails of "help me, help me." And I remember feeling this empathy, this connection to my heart, like, "Oh my God, that sounds terrible." And I just said, "Zach, don't do that. You know, you got to make him swim across that pond." And he's like, "Dad, chill out. It's just game." But I wasn't raised with that kind of technology. And so my humanity got triggered.
Yeah.
And so what I worry about is, again, these boys that have all these multiple stressors in their life and their brain marinating in this violent imagery and desensitizing themselves from the consequences of violence, and that they're being able to shoot and violate and kill and aggress without the natural consequences, and quieting that emotional place in their heart where they feel empathy. Can that be a precursor? Can that potentiate acts of violence? I think we're still studying that. There has been some recent studies that I've read where they have done some control groups where these kids were playing violent video games. These kids weren't, and the studies are showing that kids who play more tend to have a greater chance of acting out in aggressive ways. So I think we have to continue to have a conversation, and as parents and as a society, begin to think about what kind of appropriate controls we might want to have around those kind of games.
When you think about, when I think about young boys growing up, I wonder what your thoughts are about the boys who are growing up in the single parent households, whether it's the male parent or the female parent. I'm wondering if you've done any looking at how those boys tend to be and what's their potential level of masculopathy.
Well, what we see and what the research is suggesting, I mean, most single-parent families clearly are female-run. I mean, not to say that there aren't single-parent fathers out raising kids and doing a wonderful job of it, but by and large, I think you would agree, Dr. Brewer, that that's tends to be the social situation, right?
Indeed.
Yeah. So what happens is that when a young boy is being raised by a mom, that mom can do a stellar job at nurturing and caring for that young man in all these noble ways, in all these appropriate ways. And we could sit back as a society and a juror of people can say, hey, I don't know if she could have done anything different. But what she cannot do for that young man is model what it means to be a man. He's going to look elsewhere for that. She can try to teach him. She can coach him. But he's still going to be looking for men in his life or men that have the representation of men in society, media, professional sports, or something. He's going to be looking to society's definition of masculinity. And I think that's what we're trying to change by talking about masculopathy, because we believe that there's a lot of themes and messages that are sent to young boys who are looking to media that still they're still sending them really bad messages about what it means to be a real man. You look at the Buffalo Wild Wings commercials are really about men who feel the first part of masculopathy. We haven't got to the third part. Maybe we'll get to that later. But the first part I talked about, that the weak self-concept, the Buffalo Wild Wings commercial was all about the man who's at that restaurant and not able to feel man enough. He's not able to make a decision and place the order. He's not wearing the right shirt. So the coach comes in and teaches him, this is how a man does it. And so then his party is all staring at their menus. And so what's this guy do? He orders for everybody and slams the menu down and says, this is what we're eating. And everybody kind of looks at him like, what is going on with this dude? He usually doesn't act this way. So that commercial sends that old message.
Yes.
Man up. Okay. And so there's, again, a plethora of imagery about violent masculinity, about real men are invulnerable. They don't show their vulnerability. They don't open up. They don't show their sadness and fears and insecurities. They hide those, and those are not to be shown to other people. And so young boys will look up to those models. And despite their mom telling them, you know, a real man can be soft and sensitive and cry, and it's okay, honey, he's going to say, well, you're from the wrong tribe, Mom. I don't think you understand the rules of the man pack.
So it really is important for boys to have men in their lives, whether there's a dad available or not. That really is an important part of their socialization.
Absolutely. If we can get young men to be kindergarten teachers, and you look at the, you know, the predominantly female K through five, the men come in around sixth grade. You look at coaches. Coaches have an incredible influence. And I mentioned Joe Erman and him traversing America, trying to teach coaches that you have these young men in the palm of your hand, and although you're teaching them how to be a middle linebacker or a center fielder or a guard on the baseball or a basketball team, you're predominantly teaching them how to be a man. So let's have character education. Let's have time where we're not just talking about X's and O's to strategize about how to score touchdowns. Mm-hmm. Let's spend 10 minutes during our practices talking to our young boys about how they're doing in school, helping the disenfranchised feel better about being in the lunchroom. Let's have community service activities with our football players and teaching them about giving back and that's an honorable thing rather than just showing up at the football field and expecting cheers and applause from everybody. So, yeah, we need young men and men in boys' life to model wholehearted and relational masculinity.
Talk about relational deficits. I know that's one of, in your four parts of describing masculopathy, weak self-concept, inadequate emotionality, relational deficits, and externalization. Talk for a moment about relational deficits. And what I'm going to ask you to do, you give some examples of people who, in the media, who people may be able to relate to as by way of example.
Examples of people in the media.
Characters in the media who evidence relational deficits. You talk about Don Draper of Mad Men.
Right. Yeah, people who show success like Don Draper in business and have a sense of command in their life, but yet struggle with intimate relationships and maintaining intimacy and having satisfying intimate relationships. A lot of men feel very lonely, and but again, part of the male mystique is to be the lone ranger, the lone wolf, to go out in the woods and, you know, build your cabin and be able to live alone. There's this pride in being independent, and, you know, relationships are for women. We real men don't need women unless we want to have sex with them. Then we'll pursue them. So men come to intimate relationships with a lot of deficits in intimacy. Because in order to be intimate, you have to be able to know what's going on inside of your heart and in your life in terms of being able to talk about feelings. And you also have to be able to hold space for your partner to be able to talk about her fears and dreams and struggles. And if you don't know how to do that, then you're not going to be successful in intimate relationships. And so I think that, again, male socialization tends to train and socialize boys into having relational deficits rather than being able to help them experience greater satisfaction and intimacy.
Talk about inadequate emotionality. What does that mean?
Well, as I said earlier in the show, it's a way of developing language and an acute awareness of feelings. Again, we don't promote that we're supposed to be acting and making decisions in our feelings. There are certain times where we have to tell ourselves that our feelings are deceiving us. There are certain times we have to overcome our fears and insecurities and go out there and stretch ourselves and challenge ourselves. But we believe that if you don't have an awareness of your emotional life, then you're going to be more apt to act out in the shadow of feelings or think in the shadow of feelings. Just because you think that you're trying to stuff them down, it's kind of like a beach ball in the water. If you continue to kind of stuff the beach ball down, it tends to have more force and more amps underneath the water. So then you wonder, the fourth piece we talk about is externalization, why men tend to act out their feelings and explode in violence and aggression and anger is because we teach them that they're not supposed to talk about feelings.
So the best thing to do.
Gotcha. You know, so we create this bind. We that's why we're talking about masculopathy, because it's a socialized disorder. If you look at young boys, they're so comfortable running into our laps because they're scared of a spider, or coming in from outside and crying and because Jimmy and Billy won't let them play anymore, or
it's true.
You know, screaming in the middle of the night because they had a bad dream, or there's so much about boys' emotional life that's so alive, and then we teach them to suck it up and
we
to
take
stop
it away
crying,
from them.
Or I'm going to give you something to cry about.
Yeah.
And so the inadequate emotionality is not having the language for emotions and then not knowing how to manage them. So it comes out impulsively with through this process we call externalization, the acting out of feelings.
We are listening to Randy Flood, co-author of Maskopathy. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, Randy, I'd like to talk about what can be done. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Pamela Brewer continuing the conversation with Randy Flood, co-author of Maskopathy. Randy, you've given us lots of reasons to be concerned about what you're discovering, which we kind of knew but didn't have a name for it.
Right.
So now what? Do you find that men want to be different? Do men want to be healed, if healing is the right word? Is society really ready for men and women to be whole human beings? Forgive right. me for asking you 35 questions in one.
No, they're all great questions. They're all great questions. I think it'd be good to talk about them in a couple categories, one from an intervention category and then the other one from a prevention. So how do we intervene with the current state of masculinity in our culture, the men who are now 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s that have been raised and enculturated in a society that had this rigid definition of manhood that only developed half their humanity and created this disorder we call masculinity. And then how do we, if we all agree that this is something that we're all on board with, which I'm not so sure we are. I don't know if we've reached that tipping point in society where we're going to be doing what we need to do to prevent it. But I'm hopeful that this book might contribute to the conversation about that. But how do we prevent it so that boys aren't socialized into masculinity?
Yes.
Well, intervention, we believe that the mental health community over decades have gotten it backwards when it comes to the malaise of men's lives, in that they've kind of have given us fancy diagnoses that says that men have problems such as substance abuse and depression and other kinds of impulse, intermittent explosive disorders and different things like that, that create relationship problems. And that if we can fix these disorders, then they'll have better relationships. We think that that's backwards, that the reason men have these problems is because they have relational deficits, inadequate emotionality, and a weak self-concept. And until you can put men in what we believe is a resocialization process, we run resocialization groups and experiential reclamation therapy groups here at the Men's Resource Center in Grand Rapids. And we believe that men make better changes and more profound changes when you put them in a group of men. Because men are very suspect about the mental health community, about going in and seeing this, mm-hmm. Therapist with patches on his tweed jacket, who's been socialized in the psychological community talking about feelings. Or they have to come into marriage counseling, and see the marriage counselor. They're just really suspect about that. And so when individual therapists are trying to talk to them about these changes, you need to be able to be more connected to your emotions, you need to practice some your relationship skills, they don't really buy into it. But when another man who's been in the group longer than, which we call elders, mm-hmm. hey, Bill, your idea of masculinity is very old school. And I think you're really afraid of talking about what's going on in your life. And all we see is your posturing. And you come in this group every day with an arm, your armor on and a sword. And until you can put the armor off and the mask off and be real with us, we're not going to really get to know you, and you're not going to learn how to develop relationships with other men. Those kind of conversations in a group can be very powerful.
Yeah, I was about to say, it sounds powerful.
And so the man pack is this tribal, is ancient energy that we use at our center to try to re-socialize men and get them to take the mask off, take the armor off, and begin being more honest about their life. And in those group settings, we see men make profound changes. And so that's one of the intervention strategies, is treatment groups for men.
Okay.
The other thing we need to do for intervention is begin to have more accurate conversations. For example, when we do see, like, the Ray Rice debacle, most of the conversations in talk radio and is asking the question, well, why does she stay?
Mm-hmm.
What about asking the more appropriate question is, why does he hit? Why does
right.
he abuse? Why does he control?
Exactly.
Why can't he have intimate relationships and manage his emotions? How can we expect that of men? So that women don't have to figure out why she has to leave a violent relationship. So reframing and having more pointed conversations, when another shooter comes on board, rather than talking about access to mental health, which we've had greater access in 2014 than we had when my dad was going to school in 1950, but there weren't school shootings back then, we have better gun control than we did back then. We weren't having kids walk in farming communities and shooting their teacher with a shotgun and only getting two students down before they were tackled. So let's have a conversation about boys and boys' mental health rather than just talking generically about mental health and guns.
I see.
Those are the kind of conversations we have to have. When it comes to prevention, I think we need to get education in our schools about socializing boys and character education and giving boys permission to talk about these things. We need to have male mentors. We need to have coaches trained in talking about how to use character education in sporting communities. Faith communities need to have these kind of conversations. There's lots of work and training parents and educators on this issue of masculopathy and the socialization of men in American culture.
When you talk about re-socializing a society, not just men, but women as well.
Right.
That sounds like a lot of work.
It is.
Okay. All right. We're clear.
Look at the gains we've made in 50 years when it comes to re-socializing women. You know, when my mom went to school, she tells me the story that she wanted to take auto mechanics because we grew up in northern Michigan and that, you know, there's a lot of shop classes. And she was told, you know, Barb, you can't take auto shop. That's for the boys. You have to take home economics.
Right.
Well, I'm interested in cars. She liked to play baseball with the boys in the backyard, but there wasn't any organized sports for her when she grew up. So you look at the incredible changes we've made to get women graduating at a higher rate than men when we were at one point not even educating the women in our society.
Yeah, that's true.
So I am hopeful that if we can begin understanding why we're going to do this work, and I think we have to change that kind of construct, that paradigm, because there's a lot of people who still believe that we don't want to make these changes because we're afraid that we're going to make boys weak.
Right.
And until we can get people to understand that, no, we're talking about cross-training, developing full humanity. It's not going to make them weak. It's going to make them more evolved, more mature, more capable of living a whole life, not less. And so then we might have a better chance of encouraging educators and politicians and policymakers to start implementing these type of programs I'm talking about.
And it actually makes boys certainly more powerful, and it gives them more options, and ultimately it gives us as a society many more options than we often believe we have available to us.
Absolutely. I mean, Hannah Rosen recently published a book called The End of Men, and she just cites some really disturbing statistics about looking at the ascension of women in the last 50 years in categories such as education, college graduation, you know, extending in the work environment and the service connection economy. And then she cites statistics of men and their demise over the decades. And it's all about survival of the fittest. You don't have to be a Darwinian to buy into it, this idea that just as we have to do with offices and cars and furniture, we continue to evolve. Our houses used to be boxed. Now you go into a boxed house, and what do people do? They either don't want it or they gut it.
Right.
They open it up and knock down walls because they want a more open atmosphere. So society is always looking at improving and evolving, and until we see that we got to help boys evolve,
right,
or else they're just not going to be fit. How much more writing on the wall do we need to be able to see what's going on with the state of American manhood? I mean, I see the writing on the wall in indelible ink, but for some people, they don't see it at all. Or I don't know what's going on, but it seems like to me it's urgent, it's important, and we need to be talking about this.
And it is urgent and it is important, and quite frankly, I'm very appreciative of this book and the concepts that you advance. I think it's important, and I thank both of you for doing this work.
Thank you. And if people are interested in reading the book and giving us feedback, we certainly appreciate that kind of collaboration and dialogue, and they can get the book on our new website. Maskupathy, and some people might not even know how to spell the word. It's hard to pronounce. But it's maskupathy.org. And also it's available on Amazon.
So there are places where people can go to get more information. And absolutely, one of the things that I appreciate about the book is it really is very readable. So many times, you know, when you get books that are written by clinicians often, maybe, you know, you could, I don't know, watch cement dry and be a lot more stimulated. So I appreciate the way that the two of you approach the writing of this book. I thank you for that as well.
Thank you. Yeah, we tried to give a lot of great stories. We tell some of our own stories of growing up male in the book, and then we also let people be a fly on the wall in our therapy groups and get a chance to see what some of the men talk about when they take the mask and the armor off. There's some pretty compelling stories in the book. So,
job well done.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Dr. Brewer, for having me on the show.
All righty. And thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to take the place of any work you may choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you on demand at myndtalk.org. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, send me an email to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. And folks, you remember, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. Take care.